again to have Rabbi Leibowitz for our monthly shiur. Rabbi Leibowitz, I'm very grateful to hand over to you.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for coming and learning together this morning. This is a very difficult time to be coming together to do anything. It's a difficult time to function, considering the tragedy that Klal Yisrael just suffered in Meron this past weekend. So, but the best thing that we can do for an Aliyas Neshama, for all of those pure Neshamas that were lost, is to learn Torah in their Zuchus. And I was thinking that continuing in this series of Rav Moshe Feinstein and his Halachic Adversaries, to maybe highlight a person who really set the example of how to deal with tragedy, how to deal with enormous, enormous personal tragedy, and not just how to deal with it, but how he became a hero for so many people who went through similar struggles in his life. And that is the Kleisenberger Rebbe, Rabbi Kusil Yehuda Halberstam. Meaning, we've been learning about a lot of different personalities that were contemporaries of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Many of them were Holocaust survivors. All of them extremely holy Jews, all of them extremely great Talmidei Chachamim, but probably none of them are more identified with tragedy and with the aftermath of tragedy than Rabbi Kusil Yehuda Halberstam, the Kleisenberger Rebbe. So I thought that maybe today we would discuss a little bit about the Kleisenberger Rebbe, maybe a little more emphasis about the Kleisenberger Rebbe than we normally would do on the personality, just considering the circumstances. And I don't know much about his relationship with Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe, I do not believe, ever quotes him in Igros Moshe. I don't believe. I know the Kleisenberger Rebbe, and when I searched the Feinstein in the Kleisenberger Rebbe's Shuvas in the Divrei Atziv, I only came up with one hit where he disagrees with Rav Moshe about a very specific issue about checking a shechita knife. But I don't find much interaction between them. I'm sure there must have been, because these were two of the Torah giants of the same exact tkufa, and they must have interacted. I just I'm not a historian. I don't know how to do the research in finding out about their interactions. But I think the life of the Kleisenberger Rebbe is a great source of chizuk for many people. It was while he was alive, and continues to be many years later. The life of the Kleisenberger Rebbe could really be divided into five different sections. There was the pre-war life of the Kleisenberger Rebbe, there was the during the war life of the Kleisenberger Rebbe, there was the DP camps, then there was America, and then there was Israel. And each of those five are so full of inspiration and information that they deserve their own separate treatments, and they are treated in there's a two-volume biography that I once read by Judah Lipschitz about the Kleisenberger Rebbe, and there's much written about him and much spoken about the Rebbe. My own personal connection to the Kleisenberger Rebbe is that one of my great Rebbeim, Rav Asher Weiss Shlita, is a Talmud of the Kleisenberger Rebbe who was extremely close with the Rebbe. So let's go through his life a little bit. He was born in 1905. He was a great grandson Ben Achra Ben of the Divrei Chaim, the sons of Rav. He married a Teitelbaum when he was 16. She was a cousin. His uncle was a brother of the Satmar Rebbe, so he had very close connections with that family as well. He married at the age of 16, which is not so uncommon in Hasidic circles. He became the Rav in Kleisenberg at the age of 22, when there was a major split in the community over issues relating to Zionism. At that time in his life, he was a staunch anti-Zionist. He softened his stance much later in life, and the problem in Kleisenberg at the time was that the author of Dor Revi'i was the Rav, and the Dor Revi'i was an enormous Talmud Chacham, but his big mum was that he was a Zionist. So the Teitelbaum family made a big push that there should be a second shul opened up under the auspices of someone who had the requisite amount of anti-Zionism to be able to respond to the Dor Revi'i. The Kleisenberg Rebbe was always an Ishkadosh. He slept 3 hours a night, ate one meal a day, only ate bread on Shabbos. And he was offered a position as a rabbi in Palestine in 1937, and he turned it down, and then the war came. And there were early warnings that things were going to be bad, because as a Hungarian, that happened much later than it happened, let's say, in Poland. So between 1941 and 1944, he was dealing with and helping as many refugees from Nazi-occupied lands as he possibly could. And then in 1944, 1944, the Nazis came to Kleisenberg, and at some point he was hiding in an open grave from the Nazis. He was ultimately sent to Auschwitz. His wife and 9 of his children were sent there first, and all died there. He was constantly being mechazik others. He said that throughout all of the time, the people that were with him said throughout all of his time in concentration camp, he never ate non-kosher food, which is impossible to imagine. Not hard to imagine, impossible to imagine. How does one survive with whatever they were being offered? But a refusal to eat non-kosher food, impossible to imagine how one is able to survive. Obviously, he paskin for everybody else that they are mechuyev to eat their food because it's pikuach nefesh. He just couldn't bring himself to do it. And then at some point, all of the prisoners were taken to a field outside of Warsaw, and they were told to undress and stand near open pits where soldiers were going to shoot them dead. And at the last moment, a car came into the field, and an officer jumped out and gave an order from Berlin to stop the execution and send the prisoners to Dachau, where and in that moment his life was spared. From Dachau, the Rebbe was dispatched into the Muldorf Forest, where the Nazis were building an underground airport, hangar and missile batteries to bomb major European cities, and he and many other prisoners were forced to work 12-hour shifts carrying heavy bags of cement, and he was very weak from this work. Each time he collapsed, he was beaten, he refused to work on Shabbos, and ultimately his fellow prisoners persuaded the camp managers to give him a job as a camp custodian, letting him sweep and clean up the barracks while davening all day long. And ultimately they were loaded onto rail cars and driven away, and on Friday, April 27th, the train suddenly stopped in a small town. An SS officer jumped aboard and told them that they are free. Kleisenberger Rebbe said something didn't feel right. He told people, don't go anywhere, don't jump off the train. It didn't feel right. A number of people jumped off the train and were immediately shot by SS guards. It was only later that they were actually free, when an American soldiers boarded the train with candies and chocolates, as we know that they did toward the end of the war. He did survive the war. His wife and 10 children did not survive the war. He had an 11th child that did survive the war, but then died in the DP camps right after the war. So ultimately, the toll on his personal life of the Holocaust was the loss of his wife and all 11 of his children. In the DP camps, he worked very hard to try to inspire people who were broken. There's a we'll talk a little bit about it, but on Yom Kippur in 1945, General Eisenhower was visiting the camps and came to see him because he was known as a special rabbi, and the Rebbe couldn't speak until he had finished davening. He was in the middle of davening, and we're going to see that davening is one theme of the Rebbe's life that was extremely special, that was highly unusual. And he explained to General Eisenhower, I was praying before the general of all generals, the king of all kings, and an earthly general, I'm sorry, has to wait in favor of the general of all generals. And General Eisenhower appreciated his honesty, and he asked him if he could help him in any way, and immediately the Kleisenberger Rebbe said, it's going to be the Yom Tov of Sukkot, we need Dalad Minim. And he asked for the opportunity to be able to secure a set of Dalad Minim. In the DP camps, he set up yeshivos and schools for girls to be able to educate the young men and women. He fought to be able to get kosher food for the survivors, and then ultimately he came to America. And in America, he married his second wife, Chaya Nechama Unger, who actually just died about a year ago at the age of 96. And she was a daughter of the Nitra Rav. And he and his second wife had 5 daughters and 2 sons. After the war, he rebuilt a family of such a size, 5 daughters and 2 sons. And the 2 sons, one of them is Kleisenberger Rebbe right now in Netanya. I had the opportunity to meet him. I actually have a picture right on my desk of our meeting last 2 years ago. He's a Kleisenberger Rebbe in Netanya, and then the other son is a Kleisenberger Rebbe in Brooklyn. at a certain point, the Rebbe made it clear that he never intended to move to the United States on a permanent basis. Throughout the Holocaust, all he wanted to do was settle in Israel, and ultimately he set up Kiryat Sanz in the city of Netanya in Israel. And he was the first Rebbe, really, to establish a Haredi neighborhood in a development town in Israel, and he raised money to set up all the major institutions, a girls' school and a boys' school, yeshivas, an orphanage, an old age home. And in 1968, he founded another Sanz community, not only in Brooklyn, not only in Netanya, but now in Union City, New Jersey as well. And he divided his time between his place in Netanya and Union City. And then, maybe his crowning achievement, the Laniato Hospital in Netanya. If any of you ever visit the Laniato Hospital, it's a very impressive place. Everything done al pi haTorah, everything done al pi haLacha. He was a Hasidic Rebbe who built a hospital. And Rav Asher Weiss told us once that it wasn't easy to build a hospital 50 years ago in Israel. Why would a Rebbe build a hospital? Did any other Rebbe do that? And Rav Asher explained to us that it was part of his general hashkafa. He met Ben Gurion. They had a fascinating conversation. Ben Gurion asked for his minimal and maximal expectations of him. Can you imagine that conversation? Ben Gurion says to the Kleisenberger Rebbe, what would be the bare minimum you would expect from me? And what would be the maximum that you'd expect from me? And the Rebbe said to him, my minimum expectation from you is that you allow me to wear my shtreimel. My maximum expectation is that you wear a shtreimel. His expectations landed somewhere in the middle. He was allowed to wear a shtreimel and a little more. Ben Gurion never actually put on a shtreimel. He felt that we need to be involved and engaged and are responsible even for the gashmius of the tzibur. It had nothing to do with expanding his own chatzer. He didn't build a hospital to build his own following. A Gadol Ador, who's totally enveloped in Torah, Shakua B'Torah, he didn't waste any time, but he gave so much time to build that hospital for the betterment of the Jewish people, to take care of people. In fact, he gave a speech at the cornerstone laying of the second building of the hospital in 1980, and he said that he was saved from the gas chambers, he was saved from Hitler, and he said he spent several years in Nazi death camps, and besides the fact that they murdered his wife and 11 children, his mother, his sisters, his brother, he said, of my whole family, 150 people, and I was the only one who survived. He said, I witnessed all that cruelty. And he said, I remember as if it were today how they shot me in the arm. I was afraid to go to the Nazi infirmary, even though there were doctors there. I knew that if I went in, I would never come out alive. And despite my fear of the Nazis, I plucked a leaf from a tree. I stuck it to my wound to staunch the bleeding. Then I cut a branch and tied it around the wound to hold it in place. And with God's help, it healed in 3 days. Then I promised myself that if with God's help, I got well and got out of there, away from those Rishaim, I would build a hospital in Eretz Yisrael where every human being would be cared for with dignity. And the basis of that hospital would be that the doctors and nurses would believe with all of their hearts that there is a God in this world, and that when they treat a patient, they're fulfilling the greatest mitzvah in the Torah. That was his speech at the opening of the Laniato, the second building of the Laniato Hospital. He also had a tremendous accomplishment in spreading Torah, not only through his writings and his teachings, but he established an organization called Mifal HaShas in 1982. It's a project that still exists today that encourages thousands of Jewish men and boys to study enormous sections of Talmud and Shulchan Aruch, of the Gemara and Shulchan Aruch, and they take written exams on 20, 30 dapim a month, and they get paid for that. And Mifal HaShas is still something that exists today. He was an extraordinarily inspiring person. He gave a Yom Kippur drasha in the DP camps after the Holocaust, and he got up and he took out a machzer, and he said, "Nu, what does it say in the machzer? Ashamnu, Bagadnu, Gazalnu." He said, "We did none of these things." He threw it away. "We did none of these things. We didn't sin. We did nothing wrong. The only thing we are guilty of," he says, "is that we gave up hope, that we had yeyush, that when terrible things befell us, we woke up in the morning hoping to die that day, hoping not to wake up to see another day. That's the only thing we're guilty of giving up hope." And he said, that's what we have to say vidui for, and that we should never, ever give up hope again. An unbelievable, unbelievable statement in the aftermath of the Holocaust. Rav Asher Weiss told us that you cannot tell the story of the Rebbe without the story of what he lost. The Holocaust and its aftermath were the period periods that were most critical in his life. When it was over, for every Jew that wanted a Beis Medrash, there were 100 Jews that would rather a theater or a movie house. He begged for volunteers to help him bury the dead. Rav Asher Weiss told us that his father was the only volunteer to help the Kleisenberger Rebbe bury the dead. And they went on an army jeep and they had some shovels and they rode around burying Meisei Yisrael. Rav Asher Weiss didn't tell us this story, but I heard the story that at some point Rav Asher Weiss's father wanted to give up. It was just too much. You ever try, you know, we go to funerals sometimes and we just throw the dirt, we refill the hole. Can you imagine and we're exhausted and we have five other able-bodied men helping us and we're exhausted. Can you imagine digging all of these graves one after the other, famished, weak, after in the aftermath of the Holocaust? Rav Asher Weiss's father wanted to give up. And the Kleisenberger Rebbe said, "What bracha can I give you that would make you continue?" And Rav Asher Weiss's father said, "You can give me a bracha that I will have children who will light up the world with their Torah, and that will encourage me to continue." And the Kleisenberger Rebbe gave him that bracha, and he continued in this holy work of burying the dead. There was once, when the Kleisenberger Rebbe first came to America, there were Bachrim from Yeshiva Torah Vadas who were encouraged to attend his tish. He didn't have any Hasidim. So they heard there's this Rebbe, a Talmud Chacham, a Holocaust survivor, he's having a tish. And it's a chesed, go, he's going to have no one there. So go, show up to the tish. So these Bachrim from Yeshiva Torah Vadas, as a chesed, on a Friday night, they went to the Kleisenberger Rebbe's tish. And the Rebbe got up at the tish and he started talking about how he's going to rebuild the community. He's going to inspire people to learn Shas. He's going to build boys' schools and girls' schools and a kollel and a community in Eretz Yisrael and a hospital. And he went through the whole list of everything he plans on doing. And the Bachrim that were there from Torah Vadas were thinking, Nebuch, what a poor, delusional man, that this is what he thinks he's going to be able to do. How terrible, how broken he must be that he's living in this dream world. And then he went out and did it. Every single last item on his list, he went out and he accomplished. Just on the Erev Yom Kippur, on the first year after liberation, he was just an unbelievable tzaddik and an Eloi. Rav Asher Weiss told us he was preparing for the Yom HaKadosh and a girl knocked on the door and asked for a bracha, like her father used to give her on Erev Yom Kippur, but she didn't have a father anymore. So he took a handkerchief and he spread it over her head and he benched her. Then another knock, and another, and another. And he gave a bracha to every child that didn't have parents in the aftermath of the Holocaust. And Rav Asher Weiss told us that his mother was one of those girls. She was already 17 years old, and he benched them all like a loving father. And that's what he was. He was known as a takif, as someone who was very strong, but in that period, he was as soft as can be. All he wanted to do was bring the Shamos back with love and with warmth. And he was the Shadchan and Mesarer Kiddushin for Rav Asher Weiss's parents. He was very connected to his great-grandfather who he never met, the Divrei Chaim. Rav Asher Weiss told us that he heard from him many times, that he was only a bar mitzvah boy when his father passed away. But he remembers so much about his father. His father was an einikel of the Divrei Chaim, was a grandson of the Divrei Chaim. Kleisenberger was a ben acher ben. And he said one of his earliest recollections was that he was sitting on his father's lap and his father was crying. And he asked his father, "Why are you crying?" And his father said, "I'm mekane you, I'm jealous of you, because you never saw the Divrei Chaim." And Kleisenberger Rebbe was surprised. A young child, he said, "I thought it was his chus to see the Divrei Chaim. Why are you jealous of me that I did not see the Divrei Chaim?" And the father explained that after 120 years, when I go up, they're going to say to me, "You saw the Sanza Rav and you still became like you became? You weren't inspired to become holier? You weren't inspired to become greater? But for a young person, you never saw the Divrei Chaim. There won't be such a kitrug against you up in Shemayim." And Rav Asher Weiss said it reminds him always of the story of the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva and Yevamos Dav Samach Beis. They had 12,000 zugos of Talmidim who died between Pesach and Atzeres during this difficult, dark time of Svira. And they all died because Lo Nagu Kavod Zebazeh. 24 years of toil and investment in building up these Talmidim, and they didn't respect each other. And the commentaries wonder, why such a harsh punishment? Rav Asher Weiss said he always thought it was because they were zocha to be Talmidei Rabbi Akiva, Talmidim of the one who says Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzelem, Talmidim of the one who says Es Hashem Elokecha Tira L'Rabos Talmidei Chachamim V'Yahavta L'Reacha Kamocha Zeh Klal Gadol B'Torah. The Rabbi Akiva who emphasized and re-emphasized over and over again how important it is to love each other, and they saw Rabbi Akiva and did not excel in that area. That was the ultimate kitrug on them. When we experience, when we get to see an Adam Gadol, when we get to see great people, that creates a sense of responsibility. Rav Asher Weiss recalled that the Kleisenberger Rebbe, he said he was a chassid like the Balatanya and a misnagid like the Gra all at the same time. He was unique as a posek among chassidish Rebbeim. He was known as a Rosh Hashiva, a posek. One of the stories that stands out, Rav Asher said, is that his platform to speak to the world was his Chumash Rashi shir that he gave on Thursday night when he would speak his mind about whatever relevant issues. Chumash Rashi was just a chitimtza to be able to talk about whatever it was that he wanted to talk about. Once there was a person living in Kiryat Sanz who was a Yeki and moved to Kiryat Sanz because he was the manal of the girls' schools, the girls' school there, and his children were briskers. And he brought his son-in-law to get a bracha from the Rebbe. They spoke in learning, and the Rebbe was impressed, and he heard how little they get paid in the kollel. So the next Thursday night, he blasted his chassidim, saying that the guys learning in brisk learn mitoch hadchak. They learn with so little, and they're much stronger than you in learning. He said to them, I don't need your shtreimelach. I need Torah from you. I need better Torah. I need more Torah from you. And Rav Asher smiled, and Rav Asher said, he did need the shtreimelach. He was such a kanoi about Lavush. He insisted on the shtreimelach. He wanted Ben-Gurion to wear a shtreimel. Of course he needed the shtreimelach. He just always expressed himself in such exaggerated terms. The essence of his chassidus was avas ha-Torah, gadlus b'Torah, omel ha-Torah. But what I want to talk about today, even though I only have 9 minutes left, is his davening. Rav Asher Weiss recalls the Rebbe's davening. He said he was a young boy living in Borough Park, and he went for a Shabbos or a Yom Tov to 131 Lee Avenue on the Kleisenberger Shul in Williamsburg, and he looked at his face and he saw him davening and crying and talking to Hashem like a child who cries to his father, as Chazal described Choni Amagel, just talking to his father with chutzpah sometimes. And Rav Asher says those impressions of seeing a person just talking to Hashem, and he literally would just talk to Hashem. He said it was such an experience. He would cry every single Shemoneh Esrei. He would cry. He would talk to Hashem in Yiddish in the middle of Shemoneh Esrei. He would say Heilige B'Shem. For Tata in Himmel, he would just cry out to Hashem. And that's the halachic topic I wanted to discuss. That's the machlokas between Rav Moshe and the Kleisenberger Rebbe. Are you allowed to do that when you're davening in middle of Shemoneh Esrei? You're just going to scream out, Heilige B'Shefer, Ribbono Shel Olam. Are you allowed to say such a thing? So that happens to be, I don't know if the Kleisenberger Rebbe has a tshuva on the topic. I don't think he ever wrote up an explanation of why he does it. But Rav Moshe has a tshuva on the topic, and Rav Moshe is very against it. Rav Moshe and the Gris Moshe or Chaim Chel Gimel Simen Ches discusses this issue. But before we get to that, let's see a little bit of what other poskim say. There is a discussion whether all tefilos must be Belashon HaKodesh or not. We don't have time to get into the whole sugya, but basically it's a stira between two gemaras. There's a gemara in Shabbos Tav Yud Beis and Beis that tells us that the Olam Al Yishol Adam Tzrach HaBelashon Arami, a person should not daven Belashon Arami, because the Malachi HaShareis don't understand and don't recognize Lashon Arami. Sounds like you're not allowed to daven in other languages. Sota Daf Lamed Beis Amid Aleph, Elu Ne'amar B'chal Lashon. The following you could do in any language. Parsha Sota, Vidoy Meiser, Kriyashma, Utfila. Sounds like you're allowed to daven in whatever language you want. Three different approaches to how to resolve that contradiction in the Rishonim. All three appear in the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch and Simon Kuf Alef Siv Dalet writes, Yachol Yispalel B'chol Lashon Sheyirtze, V'hani Mila B'tzibur. You could daven whatever language you want, but only B'tzibur. Avol B'yachid, if you're davening alone, Lo Yispalel B'Lashon HaKodesh, and you can only daven in Lashon HaKodesh. That's the sheet of the Rif. And V'yei Shomrim, that's when you're davening for something that you need personally. But if you're just davening a shachris, a mincha, a mariv, then even a yachid is allowed to say b'chol lashon, according to the Yeshomrim. A third shita, da'af yachid kishashal tzrachav yachad lishal b'chal lashon shiir tzachutz milashon rami. The shita of the Rush that says that you're allowed to daven whenever you want in any other language. The only thing you're not allowed to do is you're not allowed to daven b'lashon rami. That lashon rami is particularly sensitive and something that the malachim do not enjoy, because Lashon HaRami is too close to Lashon HaKodesh. It's like a corruption of Lashon HaKodesh. So they prefer that you're not speaking Lashon HaRami. That's what the Gemara in Shabbos says. But you want to daven in English? So that's the third day in Shulchan Aruch. Nevertheless, our practice is certainly to speak, to daven in Lashon HaKodesh. Maybe we'll, if we have a minute at the end, we'll discuss why. But let's get to this issue. In the middle of davening, to say, Ribbono di Al Makula, Heiligabah Shefer, whatever it is that people scream out. So there's a tshuva in the Ha'elef Lecha Shlomer of Shlomo Kluger and Arachayim Simon Nunches. Shlomo Kluger was a prolific author. He wrote many, many very long tshuvas. Someone did a great chesed for Klal Yisrael and picked out Rav Shlomo Kluger's 1,000 best tshuvas and summarized them. And that's the sefer we have, Ha'elef Lecha Shlomo, a summary of 1,000 of Rav Shlomo Kluger's tshuvas. Those are the ones that are easy to read. The longer tshuvas, they're very, very long. So the Ha'elef Lecha Shlomo are short, they're to the point. In Ha'elef Lecha Shlomo, he distinguishes between someone davening b'tzibur and davening b'yechidus. He says, if you're davening b'tzibur, you're allowed to add such words, because since you're allowed to daven in other languages when you daven b'tzibur, so obviously when you're speaking in other languages, you're adding words that that aren't part of the tefillah. So it's not considered a hefsek in the tefillah. We add piyutim and things like that. But if you're davening b'yechidus, so even though it's not considered, when you add in words like that, it's not considered to be mispalel Bashar Lashon, it's not like you're davening in other languages, but it at least would be a hefsik. It would be considered like sicha betela in the middle of the davening. So that's what the Ha'elef Lecha Shlomo writes. However, comes along Rav Moshe Feinstein, Igros Moshe Arachaim Chel Gimel Simen Ches, and Rav Moshe writes, Pashut shehu hefsik va'asr. To add in anything in the middle of your tefillos is a hefsik and it's asr. V'lo mibayi be'emtza brachos. Not only in the middle of brachos, elafilu bein aprakim, even between paragraphs. Afilu b'pesukit dezimra ave hefsik. Even in b'pesukit dezimra. V'yesh lechavein banuschal shetiknu lonu chazal kefi mina kol makom. We should do like the chazal were misakin these particular nuschos of tefillah. U'bedievet b'tefillah kivin shubimeiz chozel rosh. And if you did this in the middle of Shemana Esrei, start again, says Rav Moshe. Says Rav Moshe, and I don't care why you said these extra words, it's a hefsek. So you're always going to, whether you did it on purpose, by accident, you thought it was mutter, doesn't matter. Got to say Shemon Esrei all over again. So Rav Moshe took a very strong stance on this issue, but anyone who ever saw the Kleisenberger Rebbe Davin knows that he used to do this all the time. So what's the... What's the reason? So one might say, well, you know, he went through what he went through. He has a different... He's Choni HaMa'agel. He has a different kind of relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. For anybody else, it would be a chutzpah. The Kleisenberger Rebbe is allowed to do it. However, others explain Al Pi Halacha. There's a tshuva in the Mishnah Halachas we discussed a little while back. I don't remember exactly whether it was last month or 2 months ago. 2 months ago, Rav Menashe Klein, the Yungvar Rav, was actually a Talmud of the Kleisenberger Rebbe. Because Rav Menashe Klein didn't get to learn that much. He was very young before the Holocaust. So after the Holocaust, he really was under the tutelage for some time of the Kleisenberger Rebbe. So he has a tshuva about this topic. And you could, he doesn't say it, but you can imagine in the back of his head, as he's writing this tshuva, he's thinking about his great Rebbe and that there must be a good reason for it. So in the Mishnah Halachos in Chelek Hei Simen Chavav, he says that if you look in the tshuvas HaRashba in Chelek Aleph Simen Tavayin Dalid, it's not called Mishadim Mimadbeya unless to change the text, the nusach of a tefillah, unless you actually alter the words of the bracha. But in the middle of the bracha, if you add a few words, that's not called altering the text. And he says, I'll bring you a raya. You open up a nusach svarad siddur, you open up a nusach ashkenaz siddur, you open up a svaradi siddur, a dut mizrach, you open up a nusach hari, you'll find that there are different words added in the middle of the bracha. malchus in some that don't appear in others. So it's going to turn out that that's a hefzik, that chuzah the rosh, you have to repeat the whole Shmoneh Esrei because you threw in a word that didn't belong in everybody's nusach. No, it can't be, says Rabbi Nasha Klein. It has to be the Mi'ikra Din. Since you're allowed to daven in other languages, we can't be makbid if someone says such things in the middle of the tefillah. And Rabbi Nasha Klein writes, Heyotze midvareinu, denira de'ein b'zem yishum hefzik. It's not a hefzik. Va'av shekasva go'onim, de'lechadchila in lasos kein. Even though the go'onim say you're not supposed to do it, lo kasva kein la'hamon, de'lav kalarot zalita l'shem yital. That's for regular people. Because not everybody who wants to think that he could throw in extra phrases in his tefillah is allowed to do so. Mikol makom, says Rabbi Nasha Klein, and you can imagine the Kleisenberger Rebbe's image is going through his head as he's writing this. Misha kavanaso ritsuya vaday dein maznichnoso. Someone who has the best of intentions, we cannot get angry at him or suggest he's doing something wrong. Ukfianira hayu be'emes noginas harbe mibnei adam pshutim ledam b'shmon esrei v'lechein echmir d'lechachil lo yasekein. The only reason people pushed back against it is because normal people started doing this, regular people started doing this, and that's where the problem was. Aval b'nei aliyah leka b'zeh shum isir ukemoshi birati b'ezos shem yisparach. But for very unique, special people, that is part of their avoda, that's part of their tefillah. They have a unique relationship with the Ribbono Shalom, particularly when it comes to tefillah b'tzibur. And anyone who ever saw the Kleisenberger Rebbe davens knows that they saw an image of davening that they cannot soon forget. It's seared in their memories, seeing someone like a child tugging at his father's jacket, davening for the Ribbono Shalom's help, the way that we've probably all been davening since Thursday night, the way that we approach the Ribbono Shalom and just say, Ribbono Shalom, we're lost. We just need to know that you're taking care of Klal Yisrael and that you'll watch out for these families that are now missing loved ones, and that you're going to take care of Klal Yisrael, who feels so bereft and so empty at a time like this. And we can all take a page from the Kleisenberger Rebbe's unique form of avoda, unique form of tefillah, to be able to build that relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, to realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves us, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is there for us, even though we don't really, and we don't have the kelim, we don't have the ability to understand His ways. And Be'ezus Hashem, the Ribbono Shel Olam should answer all of our tefillos in a way that we will understand and see that everything is letova. Everyone have a